Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the November 3rd meeting of the Morro Bay Planning Commission. We will start our meeting as usual. Let the record reflect that Commissioner Sorensen is absent, but we do have a quorum, and the meeting is called to order. And we will begin our meeting as usual with a moment of silence. Thank you. Thank you. And if you'd all rise and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, this is a time that's set aside for Planning Commissioner announcements. Do we have any announcements this evening? I believe we do.
I just wanted to say that we had that light night celebration, went really nice. I think they had over 100 kids there, and it was a good time that was had by all. It was a good community outreach thing. Good, a lot of love thrown.
Any other announcements, Richard? No? Okay. So we will move along to public comment. This is a public comment period set aside for anyone who'd like to speak on items that are not on tonight's agenda. So if there's anyone here that would like to do that, please come forward. Seeing none, we will bring it back to the commission and move on to the consent calendar, which consists this evening of the approval of the minutes from October 6, 2015, and the current and advanced planning list. Are there any comments, or would anyone like to pull any of those items? No? No. So do we have a motion to approve the consent calendar?
Make a motion to approve the consent calendar.
Okay. I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good. Motion passes 4-0. So then moving on to our public hearing for this evening. This is item number B1, which involves a coastal development permit CP0-488 regarding a location at 1290 Embarcadero Street here in Morro Bay. And I believe we're going to have a report from Whitney on this.
Commissioner Teft, I just want to let you know that I met with Nina, I don't know what your last name is, at the site.
Thank you very much. Any other ex parte communications to report? None. Thank you. Thank you, Richard, for remembering that. Very good. So, Whitney, now you're on.
Thanks very much. Good evening, commissioners. On the screen, we have a aerial view of the former Morro Bay power plant site, still the power plant site. This is a coastal development permit and mitigated negative declaration. It is at 1290 Embarcadero. The applicant is Dynegy Morro Bay. And I just blacked out the screen. That's great. Okay, moving right along. A little zoning map, same overhead, industrial zoning, right there on the bay, just inland of the Embarcadero. And this is a site plan of the area close to the main building with the surrounding structures that are proposed to be demolished. I'll just run through this real quickly and then continue with my presentation. And next, I just have a couple of slides just as examples of buildings. You received in your packet a selection photos of all the buildings to be proposed, what they're used for now, and what they look like. This is just a simple shed, metal storage shed, pretty typical of some of the things that they're wanting to get rid of. A larger building that was used for electrical switching gear. And this is number 22, fuel oil additive tank. Some people think it looks a little like the TARDIS, but it's going. Just briefly, the power plant, which has been here since the 1950s, officially shut down in February of 2014. Outlying equipment and structures used for storage of materials at various phases of the plant operation are no longer necessary, obviously, and pose a potential security risk. Both Dynegy and the city agreed that it would be a good idea to eliminate these outlying buildings so they didn't become an attractive nuisance. It also reduces the fire load. Am I using the correct terminology here? On the site. Both the fire department and police department are very happy to see these buildings go away. The slabs and foundations will remain in place, so no grading or any significant ground disturbance is anticipated. And demolition, once it starts up, is anticipated to take about 6 weeks' time. The staff recommendation is for the Planning Commission to adopt the mitigative negative declaration by adopting the resolution that's attached to your staff report, which includes findings for that mitigated negative declaration, as well as findings, conditions, and environmental mitigation measures for approval of this demolition project. It seems pretty straightforward, but I'm happy to answer questions, and we do have Nina Hartley here from Dynegy if you have any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. Are there any questions for staff at this time? Michael.
Whitney or Ms. Hartley, all of this is above ground.
That is correct.
Were any of these facilities connected to the plant with underground utilities? I'm specifically interested in this one.
Oh, should she come to the...
If Nina's going to speak, she needs to come up to the podium.
Sorry. Yeah. No, go ahead. You probably know better than I.
Hi, everybody. We did have some electrical that went to various outbuildings for lighting purposes. Those, as part of the plant closure, have all been determined, so there's no electricity to any of these outbuildings or any of these structures any longer.
So none of these structures have any underground piping that moved fluid materials or products?
No, the hazardous storage building had a sump in the event that there was a spill or an event inside the storage building, so that way it was contained. The VC building, which was used as a storage building, also had a vapor compressor pretty much a little mini desal plant once upon a time, and a pressure washer that was, and again, it had a sump associated with that as well. So, but as far as that, let me see. And so some of those buildings, there's conduit from the load center that has been removed, but there's still those conduit pathways that would drain water and things like that potentially.
Yeah, my only concern was if we had any materials that might be latent underground.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing like that.
Leaking,
yeah.
Or anything. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
No problem.
Okay. Any other questions for Sam?
Well, Mike, go ahead. Yeah, you may be able to answer this too. Okay, on just to follow up with Commissioner Lucas, seems like there'd be conduits, there'd be telephone, there'd be different links. Are those going to be labeled? And is there going to be a map, a ground map showing where they go in the future?
Actually, that's a good point. We just conducted an ALTA survey.
Is your mic not on?
Am I not speaking into it? Is that better? Sorry about that. My apologies. Yes, sir. let's see. We just conducted an ALTA survey of the facility and our property. So some of that will be established on that, but I haven't had a final copy. I had a utility marker out there, and most everything that was going to these buildings were tested and determined to be dead, which was what my electrical engineer did before he was laid off and before we closed the facility, is they determined all the electrical, determined all the phone lines and everything going into these buildings. But since then, we've marked where these abandoned places were just for that survey.
Okay, it seems like there's going to be, you know, there's a loss of institutional knowledge here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would seem like it would be a wise idea to create a map of existing conduits and to show where they were and where they went, and pipelines for both liquid and, you know, electrical and all of that. Is that feasible?
There's old drawings for all of that. Most of that's in Houston, but again, almost all of that has been determined and is no longer either active or any conduit. Mostly with the load centers, it's been removed as part of salvage efforts. Any electrical has been determined straight up to the load centers. All the switching gear from those load centers have been removed, so there's absolutely no potential for any electricity in those areas. And I could walk anybody down the load centers that would feed these outbuildings, which are now situated inside the power plant. They're all labeled and determined at the load center as well, so there's no electricity going outwards.
Okay. I was thinking more of the infrastructure, the existing infrastructure that's underground rather than, you know, I know it's going to be, you know, you can pull the wires and stuff, but the conduits could be useful at a later date for something that would be reconstructed there, too.
Yeah,
so if
most
there was
of
a
the,
map, you know, it could be resurrected.
There are maps of everything that once was there. Again, all those were stored in boxes in Houston, but they are accessible if there's ever a request or a concern. I've requested them in the past. I've requested them as part of this ALTA survey as well, so they are accessible. That said, this facility has been in place since the 1940s when it was a military property, and what we've found is that oftentimes there's things that are underground that aren't on drawings that were never part of, you know, the PG&E project. We don't know who laid them there. So there's often surprises. I know that when PG&E was going through and doing some groundwater monitoring, they were having difficulty finding spots that were free and clear just because of what's been there over the last few 50, 60 years.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
And if I may, Commissioner Luhr, the hazardous mitigation measure number one regarding utilities says stub cap and label remaining, and then it lists sewer, water, electric, gas, phone. So it is a mitigation measure to try and keep track of what we are able to there with this demolition project.
Okay. Any other questions for staff? So then this is a public hearing. We will open it up for so somewhat belatedly, we'll open it up for public comment. Typically, we give the applicant the opportunity to speak first if you'd like to present any information for.
I apologize. This is my first meeting, if you couldn't tell. So I'm the remaining person there at the Morro Bay Power Plant. I'm actually the environmental person. So when it comes to equipment, my understanding is pretty much up here, but I've been doing a lot of work with these ALTA surveys and what's out there and part of the effort of clearing these buildings. Most of these structures and buildings have been empty for some time over the last year and a half. All hazardous materials have already been removed from our site in order to remove ourselves from the CUPA has material business plan. So, and everything that electrically has been removed from these areas as well. Basically, they're modular tin buildings that the fire department and the police department were really concerned as far as being an attractive area for some of the transient population that we have in Morro Bay. So in order to kind of prevent that, that was our choice to try and take these down so that's not a draw, I should say, to those populations. Most of the buildings are newer. Most of them are from 1980s and older. There's about three or four structures that are a little bit older. But other than that, everything's been empty. The tanks, all but the fuel oil storage tanks, the fuel oil additive tank held water. So again, the fuel oil additive tank has been cleaned. That was done as part of closure of that as well. So there's pretty limited potential for any issues or hazardous materials involved with this project. So.
Okay. Thank you. If you can just hang around in case there's additional questions. Yeah, you can sit down, but
I'll
just
be in the front row.
Yeah. Are there any other people who would like to speak on this particular issue? Okay, so seeing none, I will ask if there are any questions for the applicant at this point before we close the.
I just wanted to make a statement. I went and looked at the property. One of the concerns I had was the presence of lead-based paints because of the age, but I was told that this is not a problem here. And I think that Whitney actually addressed it in the mitigated negative deck as well, which was very thorough. Thank you.
I had one question. It's my understanding that there is petroleum contamination of the hydrocarbon contamination of soil at the site, and also chromium. Are normal dust control measures adequate to prevent that from spreading off-site?
Yeah, so basically, I think the chromium, PG&E's had an ongoing remediation in and working with DTSE to kind of resolve any of the remediation requirements there. And I think most of the soil impacts have been cleared with DTSE now. So I would say at this point that most normal dust control should be able to handle any of that. The only thing I think that's outstanding now is some hydrocarbons in the groundwater that they're still investigating.
Okay.
Is there going to be any recycling of the newer buildings or ones that could easily be repurposed, or what's your plans on that?
I've had several people, including the city, actually contact us with some interest in some of the buildings, particularly Load Center 6, which is in the best condition. Basically, what we've been doing is telling people when we finally get through the permitting process, contact our contractor and maybe have them sub under them for any disassembly of any of the buildings that they may be interested in, but have them work under the salvage contractor so that way everybody's covered there. We're working through one person instead of having multiple parties on site trying to dismember buildings. Figure that's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Any other questions? No. So seeing none, I will close public comment, bring it back to the commission for discussion. Who'd like to start out?
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad you're doing this. I'm glad you're on the site. Welcome to Morro Bay. I guess we'll be seeing you again. The main things I was concerned about are because there were so many fluid processes about anything that remains in the ground that might be a leakage at some point, but it sounds like these projects don't have any of that. And then the document shows the mitigation for the lead paint and the asbestos. And most of these projects, if I remember the report, don't contain asbestos. So those are the biggest things I was concerned about, was the windblown lead and asbestos. And it seems like the dust control measures are not such that if there is other materials on the site, they're going to be draining to the bay. It seems like it's the misting kind of thing settles on the site, so we're not moving any potential ground materials off-site into the bay. So I'm pretty comfortable with the mitigations Whitney's identified here, especially for the cultural resources. Thank you for that.
Richard?
I agree with Michael. A very nice, thorough job. Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to walk me around the property. Yeah.
Jerry?
Yeah, it would. Excuse me. Yeah, I was just mostly concerned that, you know, once the buildings are demolished and everybody's gone, that, you know, that things that are there are labeled, and if it's a potential to have conduits mapped and pipelines mapped, and, you know, to not only what they are when they're terminated, but also where they go and how they go. It's easier now where everything's there than 5 years from now. But it seems like, you know, they've done it too. It's whatever is feasible. Also, I'm glad to hear that there's potential for some of the, you know, repurposing some of the usable buildings. But it would be good to you know, good to clean up the site. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm very happy that the person who came to talk to us tonight is an environmentalist. That's really a nice, that's nice to hear. That sort of gives me a little more confidence. And I'm happy to see the site moving on towards whatever destiny awaits it, whatever that might be. So I really don't have any major issues here. So since we all seem to be sort of in agreement, do we have a motion?
Make a motion to approve resolution 45-15, 43-15, sorry, and which includes the adoption of the mitigated negative declaration findings and conditions.
I'll second.
So we have a motion and we have a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, could we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Sadowski?
Aye.
Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Luer?
Yes.
Chairman Tuff?
Yes.
Motion passes 4-0. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Since we have only one public hearing item tonight, we will move on to unfinished business, item number C1. Which is the matter that we discussed last time regarding a resolution dealing with the question of greater than normal public benefit. And since Scott's the only one left with us, I guess we're going to prevail on him.
Yes, thank you, Chair Teft. As was stated, this is a continued item from the previous Planning Commission meeting of October 20th. So what we were putting together was an interpretation for greater than for a significant or greater than normal public benefit. And those items are covered under the plan development overlay zone in the Morbid Municipal Code, specifically chapter section 1740.30, and the waterfront master plan, specifically design guidelines in chapter 5. I think the basics that we took away from the previous meeting was that we wanted to apply the same standards, whether we were referring to the PD guidelines or the waterfront master plan guidelines. And so applying a standard that utilizes both or applies to both the greater than normal public benefit statement or significant public benefit statement. The base finding for the policy for greater than normal benefit or significant public benefit would include that there must be a nexus between alteration in the standards and achievement of proposed benefit, and such benefits cannot be obtained if usual development standards are applied. And a second component of that is to improve public access or views in some substantial way to establish nexus between what is offered and the exception requested. So what that means is if you're proposing to diminish some standard, to alter some of the one of the base standards for or go into that top tier height, you know, we go above 17 feet to 19 or what have you, then you'd be required to show how you're providing a significant public benefit in the form of, by going up higher, you're reducing views, or if you're suggesting that you want to reduce a view corridor on lease sites that are 50 feet or more in width, you're required to have 30% of that in open view corridor, and if a project came forward and wanted to have less than 30%, then they should be offsetting that view impact in some meaningful way that improves views, public access, recreational opportunities in some other format. So that's the resolution that we put together that sort of touches on that in the staff report. It pulls some of the language that was out of the specific sections, and then used some of the language that I think you might recall that Dr. Teff had put some language together, and so we used some of the language that was in Dr. Teff's paper that he put together, and combined that with some of the language that's either in the PD overlay or was in the waterfront master plan. And so we provided a resolution, specifically Resolution 4415 for adoption by the Planning Commission. You have copies of that in your staff report as Exhibit A. I think with that, I'll conclude my comments and take questions or comments.
Good. Are there any questions for staff at this point?
Scott, one thing we talked about was it has to be on a project-specific basis. So it's assumed the benefit would be at the point of the project being built. There's no holding capacity for credits or lateral thinking unless there'd be something already in the overlay district or something like that accommodating such things, right? So it's meant to be project specific. You deliver something specific on this site.
Yes, that's exactly it. Okay. And so when I, back to my previous statement, when I was saying that so you want to widen your building, and that's going to give you that view quarter that I talked about that's less than 30%. Well, how are you going to increase that, you know, public's access to views or public access to it? One of the way would be having a viewing deck. Another way might be that lateral access way across the back is normally supposed to be what? It says in the waterfront master plan, it says 8 feet, but the requirement's actually 10, right, from the Coastal Commission, so it has to be 10. So maybe you're reducing that width by 4 feet, but you're going to expand the walkway that everybody has access to by that same 4 feet or 5 feet. And so that would be, you know, something where you're going, oh, okay, so we're going to increase that public access across the back and make it wider. So that might be something that you would consider for something along those lines. So I think that's kind of the intent behind this.
Okay. I guess in the future, though, if we did specific overlay districts, we could say something to the effect of if there was a public benefit, let's say in the downtown section with your specific building, if we have a downtown overlay district, you could offer, I'm going to bulb out street corners to make it easier for pedestrians to go through, or I'm going to contribute to some kind of waterfront stair condition at the end of our street here or something like that. In other words, we don't have anything identified that's a reserve to put things into. So therefore, it doesn't make any sense to have that option at this point.
So, I mean, if we wanted to get down that road, you know, that's a larger policy discussion to have. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, it's a much larger policy discussion to have, really, because if you think about it, we're going to be going down the road of the general plan update. It's going mm-hmm. to inform our land use documents that are in place. One of those documents is going to be looked at as the waterfront master plan. And it'll probably, that planning process will identify that waterfront master plan probably needs to be updated. It's old, mm-hmm. and it probably could use, you know, a little tuning up. Mm-hmm. It sort of lacks specificity in some cases. It's got a little bit of, there's some gray areas, and it's kind of unclear sometimes what it means, and it's created some inconsistent application of policies over time, which is one of the reasons we're trying to come up with a definition resolution here this evening.
I just want to make clear, this is the way it's set up and the way we're going to discuss it, it's site-specific.
At this point, yes.
Okay.
Any other questions for staff? So we'll bring it back to the commission for discussion. Why don't we start with you, Richard? You're next in line.
Okay. first of all, I want to thank you, Chairman Teft, for all your work on the overlay from last time. I went to a Harbor Advisory Board meeting, a special meeting, and I'm very concerned here with what's going on at the Harbor Advisory Board, because what it appears is that one of the things that was discussed is having a ad hoc committee and talking about the development on the waterfront. And then bringing it and meeting with a vendor like RRM, and then going to city council completely circumventing what we're doing here at the Planning Commission. And I think that we need to get a little bit more collaboration on what is really going on, especially in the waterfront, because it's the discussion is kind of nervous. They were talking about a three-story marine center. They're talking about all these kind of things, and I'm like, I think we need to have. I actually suggested that they have we have a collaborative meeting with Harbor Advisory and the Planning Commission, maybe, you know, going to the mayor and asking that before they go right to council. But regarding this, this is a much needed. I like the spirit of what's happening here. We're tightening it up and getting good language so we don't have ambiguities. But that said, I think it's a cause of concern.
I'm going to speak to that, your concern. So internally, things, you know, as far as leases go and that type of things, those are housed in the Harbor Department, you know, the Harbor Director, Eric Hendersby. I've noticed, the city manager's noticed, our deputy city manager has noticed, that the process that goes along with redoing leases and redeveloping leases has probably been one that has quite a few holes in it, because we're not all looped in. And what I mean by that is I see issues when things come back and I'm talking to somebody that's an applicant that's coming before us, and they tell me, oh, I already showed this to the city council, and they said it's okay, so you, the Planning Commission, you know, you guys have to approve what I brought forward. And so that's a disconcerting comment to have come to me, and would probably be to you if it was said in open session, the Planning Commission meeting. And so we're changing how we do that. So all lease, anything that's all applications that come forward to extend leases that include improvements and those types of things are going to be reviewed by myself, by the Harbor Director, by the City Manager, by the Deputy City Manager. Collectively. So we're all looking at all of the facets of these, because sometimes things come forward that really are inconsistent with policy direction that the Planning Commission has given. We have an example that's going to come on the heels of this that is pretty inconsistent with these policies that you're going to be seeing coming up here in the not just the future. So this is a timely effort that we're doing now, because it reinforces what I've been telling the applicant about what the requirements are and what the expectations are for development on the waterfront. But again, your point's well taken. Noticed over the year plus that I've been here that this process is sort of missing some pieces to it and probably needs to be more collaborative in-house, and so we're doing that now. And so that's something that we've made a change to within the last couple of weeks. So there'll be less of that, and there probably won't be having any boards go off on their own. That'll probably get reined in a little bit as a result of that, just because it does reside in the existing documents that we have, and it would be any change to those documents, our land use documents, that while would include the Harbor Advisory Board, would also include this board. So.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. I really appreciate that.
Jerry?
Well, I've got a question about the leases and so should we handle that later, or should we just deal with?
I'm happy to answer if I can.
Okay. Well, through the years, it seemed like leases are, you know, renewals or have not gone out to public bid.
Yeah.
So is that policy being reviewed?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. The intent is to go out for RFP for most of them moving forward.
Okay, great.
So the characterization of how leases happened in the past is your lease was coming due, and you went into the back smoky room and, you know, hammered out a deal, and it came out, and voila, you had a new deal. And I think to some extent the council sort of saw that and thought, and so the council's position on this has also been, these things need to be delayed more, discussed more. It's why you see them happening much more at city council, but But also the discussion's been, hey, we should be sending these out for RFPs, because who knows what we could be getting if we're not doing that. And, you know, the opportunity missed is, again, the opportunity missed. And so there's a recognition on the part of staff and the council, really, that's potentially happening, not necessarily. But we want to know. And so we're going to be doing that. You're going to see that much more frequently when leases come up. So. Great.
Thank you.
Did you have more to say on the resolution, or?
No. Actually, I think this is a good clarification. And then it just remind me, because now this is for all PD overlays.
It would apply to, because it does include that policy. So you have the waterfront master plan, and it right. basically says, you know, if you're greater than your normal public benefit, it refers you over to the PD policies. It says, hey, go look over there. And so this is leading into both of those things. That's why I said we're using both of those terms in here collectively, because we should be treating them the same. Based on our previous conversation, we want to be putting that out to everybody, and so then that would be applicable in other areas as well.
Okay, thank you.
Michael?
I don't have any comments.
Scott, thank you for this. There is one thing that I have no problem with anything that's here, but there's something that's not here that I'm a little concerned about, and that is your staff report at the last meeting gave a number of examples of this. As a matter of fact, the situation where an applicant comes in and says, I've got this project on the waterfront side, and I'm giving you 30% view corridor, which is exactly what the ordinance says, and claims that to be a greater than normal public benefit. The one thing that I think is lacking here is that the concept that just doing what the ordinance requires you to do is not a greater than normal public benefit. And I would like to see that stated very explicitly, so there's no gray about it.
We could add a section 4 to this that does that. Internally, we had a discussion about this actually before the meeting today. So.
Well, I would be strongly in favor of that, because that's one of the common, you know, misunderstandings or miscommunications or misrepresentations that we see actually happening. And I think that's one of the things we need to clear up, you know, so that people just get it, you know, that what the code is calling for is normal public benefit. And if you want an exception or a change in standards, you need to do more than that. I'd be happy to hear what the rest of the commission feels about that, but I just think that's kind of part of the heart of this whole concept.
I'll make a comment. That's the nucleus, I think, of what we talked about last time. And so I don't know what kind of language we could put in, but I agree 100%.
It's not that difficult. I could just be explicit about it and state that fact. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because that is something we've talked about, and it's something that we actually currently talk to applicants about now. I mean, I've requested some justification letters recently on some of the projects down there, and they gave back with just those things. I said, that's unacceptable. You're telling me that you're compliant and that you're, again, the point that Chair Teft has made in the past, that your new project's going to be better than the existing one. I'm like, I hope so. It's kind of, but I think the point's well taken, and there's examples that we're getting now that are of that, so we might as well just state it. I mean, that's fine. I have no problem with that.
So, let me ask a procedural question. Would it be appropriate for us to approve it with that modification, or would you rather us continue it and have you bring back the actual wording?
It's really your comfort level. I mean, I'm going to be explicit and stated exactly as we've discussed, you know, for the most part. I think that it's it's something we talked about quite a bit last time, and it didn't really, the feeling of that didn't really make it into the resolution, and so I agree with that. I mean, if you want to see it back, though, I don't have a problem bringing it back. It can come right back to the next meeting. So
yeah, we have it in the minutes. We have it in this discussion. So I feel like it's there already. You know, I would probably be happy seeing the actual text before.
Okay.
You know, I have to sign it. How's everybody else?
It's pretty much. But it's almost no extra work to bring it back to the next meeting.
Well, if we're all comfortable with that, then let's just have a motion to continue it till our next meeting would be good enough, Scott?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Correct. Mm-hmm.
So it'd be November 17th, right?
It would be the 24th.
Oh,
that's right. We got bumped by the city council. We go.
Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah.
My mind's like a steel trap. It's very rusty. So do we have a motion to continue this to our November 24th meeting?
I'll make a motion to continue discussion on the resolution PC44-15 to the next meeting on November 24th. 2015.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Can we have a roll call on that? Or we can just do it by... all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes 4-0. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Okay. So we're moving on to item number C2, which is the sign ordinance and review. Is everybody comfortable? Nobody need to write. This could be a longish one. Okay, so this is a review of the current status of the update on the sign ordinance, and I think Scott's going to have some comments to make on this.
Yep. Okay, thank you, Chair Teft, members of the commission. Let's see if I can. There we go. So we're dusting off the sign ordinance and bringing it back before you. It's set on the shelf for a little while. We did a bunch of work back in 2013, 2014. We had staff turnover. I was part of that. Are now getting back to it. So you take a look back historically. Back on September 4th, the Planning Commission, on a 3-2 vote, forwarded a recommendation to the City Council for approval of the new sign ordinance, which is in, I think, your attachment 1. Or 2, attachment 2, I guess. And then the City Council reviewed the ordinance at their meetings of October 8th and October 22nd of 2013. I think they felt that it wasn't quite ready for prime time, and then provided direction that we bring it back to the Planning Commission after holding some community workshops. The sign ordinance breaks up our commercial districts into 4 districts, and they suggested that we go meet with each one of those districts and conduct some more outreach. We did that outreach in conjunction with the Chamber. They did a really good job of facilitating getting the folks there that were interested in it. And we held meetings on November 11th in the Quintana area. Interest that came out of that meeting was for those sort of flags, feather signs or blade signs, really in association with one business from what I could tell. Met on March 10th of 2014 with the downtown business owners. They had interest in A-frame signs and where those could be located. On April 28th of 2014, we met with the North Main business folks. Their interest seemed to center on freeway or highway-oriented signs. There are policies in the current sign ordinance that allow for highway-oriented signs. On May 19th, we met with the Embarcadero folks. Their concerns seemed to center on, there's some of the tenants there that have tenant spaces that don't have direct access. You can't see them from the Embarcadero. And so they were concerned about signage and wanting signage on the front of the building. Conversely, the sign ordinance says, if you have more than three businesses in your building, you're supposed to have a master sign plan, and you're supposed to implement that sign plan when one tenant comes forward for a sign permit. So that concern's probably been addressed by the existing ordinance. I guess the issue would be if you had one building that had a tenant on the back and there were only two occupants or something, then maybe you have an issue then. There were some other things that that came out of those meetings. One of them centered on the sort of convoluted nature of obtaining a sign permit. They wanted a streamlined process that was clear, an application process that was clear, possibly a system where you could submit to both building and planning for your sign at the same time. My answer to that is one of the things we're working on right now is the implementation of our new project tracking software. That's going to streamline our permitting process on all fronts quite a bit. It'll also allow for electronic submittals of applications, including sign permits. So we'll be able to streamline that process, come up with good submittal checklists and those types of things. If people follow them, then they would be able to get potentially sign permits over the counter. So we do have some things in the works that would facilitate at least one of the concerns that they had. As I said before, this sort of effort did sort of stall in 2014 as a result of turnover in staff. Again, I sort of came out of that turnover. When I came on board, we had some focus on a few different things. And so I'm just now getting back around after completing design guidelines and starting the implementation for our new project tracking software, getting to this now. I was able at the beginning of summer to sit down with some of the folks in the downtown. They had some concerns and issues about signage, and they asked that I come and meet with them. We met in the Ruby Dragon and met with a bunch of them, along with it was myself and council member Christine Johnson. Had a really good conversation with them, about signs and what opportunities there are and where's the sign ordinance. They said we did some work on it and the city left us sitting here with no new sign ordinance. In fact, they even took what we had come up with to this point and as a group kind of went back over it, really trying to streamline the process for their sort of A-frame signs that they're really fans of in the downtown. So they gave me back all those comments. I haven't digested all of them yet, but will as part of this effort moving forward. Sort of the next steps, I want to go through, update the language. We've had a recent Supreme Court ruling on signage, and we need to sort of go through the ordinance and make it consistent with that recent ruling. There's also some, I think there's some lack of specificity in some areas in the ordinance I'd like to clean up as well. So I want to go through and do that. And then I want to go back out and it seems like we met with those areas and it doesn't look like when we were having those workshops that we had really good interactions because they were still coming up with concerns that they had related to things that were resolved in the ordinance. And so when I was looking through the notes that were taken from them, that's kind of what I took away from it. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to go through and sort of update everything, get it squared away from a legal standpoint, take whatever input I'm going to get from the Planning Commission, I might as well go and meet with those folks again. And so that's my intent. I want to meet with them over the next 3 months, 2.5, 3 months, and see if I can't bring out the updated ordinance, show it to them, make sure we got the correct feel for it, and then bring it back to the Planning Commission for consideration and a recommendation to the City Council. So, like I said, those workshops will probably be November, December this year. And then my idea would be to polish that up and bring it back for consideration by the Planning Commission January, February. Probably give you a couple of meetings at it. I think it'll probably take that to get it all finalized and out the door. And then that would be a recommendation on to City Council, hopefully. And with that, I just wanted to kind of daylight the process I was going to go through and take whatever commentary you had related to the existing ordinance and use that in my polishing efforts.
So just to be clear, what we're doing tonight is sort of a preliminary comments. In other words, we don't have to concern ourselves with periods and semicolons at this point because it'll be coming back at some point.
Absolutely. I anticipate after I get everything back from the business folks in those areas, then there might be some tweaks and I'll make some changes to it. And then I'm going to bring it back and I'm going to invite all those folks to the Planning Commission meetings. So I'm going to get take names and contact information and that type of thing, and then invite them here. And I figure our we're gonna have a couple of meetings that are probably sign ordinance related. It'll just be the signs, and I'll invite them to come. It'll be more of a a little bit of a workshop, and we'll see if we can't get through it. But Chair Teff did provide me some comments, and I was kind of looking at those before the meeting and last night as well. And a lot of really actually good points that you provided in that information to me. And there's, so those are some of the holes I was talking about in the ordinance actually stem from that and my review. So I'd be happy to take any commentary that you have this evening.
Okay. So are there any questions for staff at this point? Now, I noticed that a member of the public has come in. This is not a public hearing item, but is there any objection if I ask if they have input? If you would like to give us input, you're more than welcome, or if you just want to enjoy our witty comments, then that's okay, too.
Well, I'm Jeff Heller, and I just stumbled in here. I thought the place would be packed like it normally is with unadded people. But I'm applying for a position on the advisory committee, the general plan, in a couple of weeks, and so I'm cramming to learn as much as I can about planning in the next 2 weeks. So I thought I'd come down to the meeting. So that's why I'm here. I have no idea or input on anything you're talking about, but I expected a room full of raucous people, and I could sit in the back. But anyway, that's why I'm here. Scott, nice to see you.
Yeah.
Meet you.
So
we're glad to see you here. Okay, so then I will bring it back to the commission for comments. I think you're up, Jerry.
I'll be looking forward to seeing this again, but just a couple items that I think you might address when you talk to the rest of the city is possibly having a sunset clause for non-conforming signs, so that after 10 years if a business hasn't changed, and there's no other mechanism for changing the sign, that it would sunset in 10 years, so that they would be required to remove that sign at that point.
Lots of sign ordinances have those in them. Okay. Not common.
And then the other thing is we dealt with it here on the Burger King. The Burger King property is. What is a sign and what is an architectural element? And
a question we never even dreamed we would need to address.
Something's an identifiable logo, it seems like it's a sign. But I think we hashed around that one, but I think that needs to be addressed in the communications.
Okay, sure.
I think in addition to what Commissioner Lure is saying, we might want to see if there are any historic signs or signs we want to specifically grandfather because of their character. Because there may be a few of those. I'm thinking the theater, and I know at one point we talked about the GAFCO sign that was on top of the roof there. I'm not sure how many there are. I'm having a hard time remembering many signs here. The Burger Chef one will always be in the back of my mind.
In looking through the volume of sign information. I mean, you guys were working on this for a while before, it looked like, because there was a lot of information there. There was a discussion about that, and they went around and did some preliminary survey. So, I mean, I just took a note. I'm going to go back and look through that, because I saw that in there, and it was a little over the top of the, the list was something about historic signs. So there was some discussion at some point about it.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have to be up to, in other words, it could be an application that somebody could put in and say, I've had this sign for a long time, I like it, I would like it to be, and then, it wouldn't necessarily have to be the city going out and making a list.
I was just saying that I saw something in there when I was stumbling through it that I said I'll have to go back and look. It wasn't what I was looking for when I was looking through the information. I was looking for something else, but I did notice there was something in there about that. So.
But it seems like that process should come before the Planning Commission or the mm-hmm. City Council or something, instead of just
absolutely.
An automatic. If you apply for it, then you're granted a historical sign. I remember on the miners. Public, or the PUD the development permit for minors, we granted the sign there is a historic sign on the warehouse area.
I guess the other thing I was thinking of is are the stakeholders comfortable with those four districts? Because it seemed to me they made a lot of sense, but if they have any concerns that those districts aren't viable entities in and of themselves, because it struck me the biggest thing I remember is there were sort of questions of taste in the different districts between what was acceptable and what wasn't. And I don't have any, signs are not my thing I worry about too much, to be quite honest. But my concern is I think getting a good buy-in on the discussion talks about where that point is amongst the, the stakeholders in any particular district, because they are really different districts. I mean, I remember thinking they really don't have anything in common with the way they talk about signs because they're so unique. And so I'm fine with that. And I don't know if there's sub-districts or something like that, but I was very interested in, there seemed to be a lot of discussion about some of these things. But I remember there were specific sign types. It could be that A sign that I'm remembering in the downtown district was actually kind of controversial with some of the stakeholders. And so, getting a large buy-in from the, economic interests in the community about store owners, about what the bar would be they'd like to see, I think is important to me. And, ultimately, this is coming before we do any general plan or specific plans for areas, but this would be something that I think feeds into that, in a way. It starts to establish what the nature of the streetscape character is in each of these areas. So in some ways, it's a precursor to the specific plan kind of thinking that comes forward. I just think, in general, we're trying to encourage a pedestrian community and pedestrian shoppers and longer shopping experiences and paths and things. And so I'm really concerned a little bit about how much we put on the sidewalks as opposed to allowing in the buildings, because every time we put a sign in the sidewalk, we've lost the capacity to potentially have passage if somebody wanted to put seats outside it starts to... I've never really understood some of the street signs relative to the number of cars along the sidewalks, because the cars kind of block the signs when you're parking versus the street traffic. If you're walking, you tend to see them. So I think each district's very different. I just hope there's a large buy-in, because to me this is a kind of the taste of the owners coming together and making a decision about what's appropriate there.
I got an email from somebody and I don't know if this is a temporary signs or whatever, but it was from a clutter standpoint, like too much signage, and then there's these temporaries or these events or those kind of things. And I don't know if we have any kind of like permits for that. Or, there's a stand. A couple people have a stand right next to the anchor there with their thing. And that's...
We have a lot of non-permitted signage in town. Over time, some of that will probably change as we transition into doing more active code enforcement. We've identified two code enforcement folks, offered the positions, they've accepted, and I'm in the process of bringing them in-house right now. So some of that clutter, businesses having 10 signs on the front of it, won't persist, because that's one of the top 10 items that we're going to be probably looking to enforce over time. And so we're doing a sort of outreach campaign with that, and we'll be sending informational notices out on those top 10 items. Signs is one of them. So we're in the we'll be in the process of doing that as soon as we get the code enforcement folks in house. Actually, we've already started some of it and notifying folks. We've done a couple. Bay News article. There was another article covered in the Trib, and I think we've done one utility bill mailer as well that talks about some of that. So we've sort of been, you know, greases in the wheels a little bit ahead of time, you know, sort of preparing folks to get that, but it would pick up some of that. On the other side of that, what you talked about was, you know, maybe what I thought I heard you say was something about in the public areas where we have parks in town and things like that, we do probably need to take a look at that policy a little more clearly. In the new ordinance, there's some language that talks about we can issue permits for things like that. There's not a lot of, say it again, specificity about what that means. That thing probably needs to be bolstered or pulled out of the sign ordinance entirely and put in, you know, one of our other chapters that deals with those types of things because it's on public property. And that's something that's going to have to be discussed as part of this overall sign process. Do we want to regulate them out of the sign ordinance, or do we want to have them in a separate section because they deal with public property?
But doesn't it require an encroachment permit because it is on public property?
A lot of the signs that we have that are on public property are city signs. We don't issue encroachment permits to ourselves.
Right.
But we do, but you're correct. We do allow, in some instances, signs on public properties. You can get a permit, pay a fee, and it can go out there. And that's mostly done through our recreation department of all things, although that's not what the ordinance says. It says it's supposed to come through community development. I don't know how that process was derived. It's obviously been something the city's done for years and years and years, and I think maybe no one actually looked at what the code says, is my guess. We've been having an internal conversation because recreation is now, you know, overseen by the deputy city manager. He's brand new, and so he and I meet a lot and talk a lot about this stuff, and I go, it's in the zoning code and the sign ordinance, but it, you know, his folks are the ones issuing permits in those areas. So
It almost seems that the basic issue is a very specific, I mean, because obviously there's a benefit to the public knowing about events that are going on in the community, and there's a benefit to having the entrance to the community look nice, and so maybe it's just a question of, maybe it's not a question of should we do this or shouldn't we do it, but where should we do it? Mm. You know, what's the appropriate way of doing it?
Yes, and you run into problems when you're advertising for things that aren't city sponsored events. We've actually literally just having the conversation today with the city attorney about not doing those types of things, because if you make it available to one set of folks, you have to make it available to another set of folks, and they could be folks you don't want advertising in your park, as an example. And I won't go into specifics, but you know, and it was a point well taken and something that, you know, we're taking under advisement at this point. So
The other thing that, and I don't know if it applies here, but I could speak from an experience, and it's from your old town, Pismo. I was putting a sign up on my business, and there was a talk if it's a statue or not. Basically, it was a big old hand that was holding a cup, and so I ended up having to go to the city council meeting and then defining what a statue is and all that. But the semantics that's involved. We're in an artist community, so I think that we should have a little bit of creative freedom in there too, you know, for that, you know.
The ordinance does have a section for murals. Specifically says you can have a mural, but it shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't have your logo. If you're selling Coke products, shouldn't say Coke on it or whatever your product is. Whatever it is your business is, it should be just a mural of whatever. So it does. We do have a policy in there, so a place to start with. You probably want to take a look and see what the language in there says and see if you think, well, we should expand it to include X, Y, or Z. I don't know. Or not expand it and make it more constrained. I don't know.
But yeah. Okay. Scott, I didn't notice it, but do we have any verbiage in there on going out of business signs or liquidations signs? Seems like there should be limitations on.
That would, wouldn't that be a, wouldn't
how many
that,
times you can go out of business?
Wouldn't that be a sale sign? There is a limitation on sale signs.
Yeah, it would be a temporary sales type sign, and there are limitations to the number of days you can have those, the size of the signs, the number of days in a year that you can have them, that type of thing. It's like 60 days total, no more than 30 in a row or something. And
There's instances here where they're going out of business and liquidating all stock, and the same business has been doing that
until they get more stock.
Yeah. And then so shouldn't there be a requirement if they're going out of business that they actually have to get a new permit or something?
My answer to that is I think the ordinance probably adequately addresses it, because it only allows for those special type. It says you're a business and you're going to have some kind of special whatever it is, and it gives you the opportunity to put that temporary sign up that says you're doing that. But it limits how long you can do it for. It gives you a limitation, and it gives you a limitation to square footage for that signage as well. Yeah, so it wouldn't be something that could be put up there in perpetuity. And I think the total number of days in it is like 60 or something. I'd have to go back and look specifically, but it says something along those lines.
Yeah, this just is a personal. It irks me because it's so fraudulent, and it seems like, it detracts from the city. And I don't have a problem with sale signs and stuff like that on limited times, but it seems like if you're making a statement, that statement should be true. And
instead of your marketing campaign.
Yeah. So, is there any way, or is it legally possible to enforce that?
Separately from the banner and sale limitation, probably not.
And so it couldn't be a prohibited sign unless a one-time usage or something.
I don't know. I'd have to look into it. I'm not exactly sure. I when you have the certain categories, it depends how you treat them. I'm not exactly sure the answer to that. I mean, I'd have to look into it a little bit.
Okay. I don't know, maybe it's a personal peeve, but it does, it goes to veracity, I think.
Well, I have a number of comments some of them are quite specific, and I will save them for our next review. But there's a few issues that I think need to be discussed at this point. One of them is, I think, Scott, it's very important as we move forward with this to go out to take a look at the community and see what the issues are that are not addressed currently. There are several that I see as sort of increasing that aren't dealt with in the ordinance. First off is neon, okay? What's appropriate, what's not appropriate? The second one that I see proliferating is blackboards. All of a sudden, there's blackboards everywhere. Some are freestanding. Some are, some are mounted on buildings. But, it's a changeable type kind of sign. But where does it fall? I think it needs to be defined where it falls in all
this.
Yeah,
there's the menu type sign if you're a restaurant that you can have in there.
Yeah, I took that to be more as posting a menu or, having a
specials
written menu
thing or something. Maybe,
yeah, and some of them are not restaurants. Some of the places that are doing it are.
I've seen what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
And the third thing that I see, all over the place is these little handwritten signs, Buy one, get half off, stuck on racks of clothes or stuck on, how do we want to address those? And the fourth thing, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but something it's not spoken to, is the posting, is putting up posters. Is a poster a sign or is it something different? Many businesses put posters in their window for, concerts that are coming up or whatever. I'm just saying I think that's an issue that ought to be looked at, in terms of how we want to deal with it.
So, maybe you're right. The poster's not necessarily a sign, but it's advertising. So maybe we change
where does it fall?
Maybe we add that into the definition so we can pick those up. Because I think the intent by that, because there's a section of the code that talks about, signs that you're going to have in your window, and those could be products, they could be what have you, and there's a limitation to the square footage. So we probably could wrap it into those types of things, saying, you know, the square footage allowed for those could be allowed for these types of things, and that would be just the limitation, the same limitation.
But a window sign comes out of your total signage square footage, and if it's posters that are coming up and going down,
I would say the requirement would be the same. It, right now, the regulation of something like that is near impossible. I mean, I'm not sending my planners out going door to door to do that. That's probably not the best use of their time.
Right.
But we are getting code enforcement officers. That's probably a little more along the, you know, what they should be looking at when they're out there, given that we're going to focus on signs. So, I think it is probably something that we could feasibly regulate as long as we're getting the word out there that, hey, you shouldn't be doing these types of things. So, yeah, I think we...
Well, and there's a policy in there for sort of for posters for nonprofit events, but some of these are profit. You know, they happen to be at a winery or something. They're not, you know, they may not be for the SPCA. They might be for, you know, such and such winery. So I just something, those are areas that I think we should look at. More substantive and sort of more germane to tonight, I think, is, and a bigger issue for me, is the question of internally illuminated signs. I'll just say my opinion, guys. In my opinion, those kinds of the plastic signs with the internal illumination are generally, in my opinion, not consistent with the small town character of the downtown area or the quaint fishing village atmosphere of the Embarcadero. I just don't see, you know, these Midas muffler type signs, you know, adding to the character down there. We don't have them now. The only internally illuminated sign I can think of on the Embarcadero right now is the Shell Shop, which is, in my opinion, a historic sign. You know, I like that sign. It's great. But in my opinion, that's not a direction that we want to go in those two areas.
So then the preference would potentially be to have externally illuminated signs?
Correct.
Okay.
Here's where I think we have to make some distinctions, because right now, internally illuminated signs would include, for example, the signs that have the metal letters that are set out from the wall.
Channel letters.
Yeah.
That's
I don't think that's as objectionable as the plastic ones with the, you know, bright colors and, you know, and I don't know where neon falls in terms of being internally or externally or...
When I was in Pismo, it was specifically encouraged.
It's kind of a...
I wouldn't say that that's probably where Morro Bay is going, but... just kind of depends on what your community is into, I guess. Yeah. So can we talk about that a little bit? So channel letters might be something, because I have policy language for channel letters that we could, that would be a preference to the can signs. You don't really like those.
Define channel letters.
Channel letters are those individual, they're the individual metal letters that could go on a building, and so they would be whatever the business name
no,
is.
No, the type of lettering I'm talking about, which I think is not in this category, is you see, like, there'll be like metal letters that are set out from a wall and the lighting is coming from behind them, not from within the letters.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Sometimes it's just called dimensional letters.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is, you know, kind of at this point, it's just kind of making a choice about, you know, what those areas are going to look like in the future. And I think it's kind of an important choice.
Some of the offenders would, in like the downtown, would be a bunch of the motels and hotels that got the can signs that are internally illuminated. But a couple of them out there have signs that are externally illuminated. They got, you know, they're a painted sign and
right.
They have a light on the outside
right.
of them, and they look just as good as the, you know, you can see them just as well as you can the other, I think. So point well taken.
Yeah, and the other thing, with most of the downtown area and the Embarcadero area, they're pedestrian areas. The majority of the people that are in those areas are not, they're not driving through at 60 miles an hour. They don't need this, you know, giant internally illuminated sign in order to see it. You know,
yeah, I like, again, on a personal level, I don't like the neon or the LED and all that. It ruins your night vision. And plus, I think that it's not consistent with, we don't want to look like Times Square, you know? We kind of have that. Is there still a night ordinance, a night sky ordinance that we have here? And maybe that can be kind of laced in there.
And we do have requirements for, you know, shielding lights from above and all those types of things. So, yeah, the dark sky ordinance, yeah.
Yeah, but what about the impact on the view of the bay at night?
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we keep talking about not impeding the public's access and view of the coast, and we're putting up a light that, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, this is an interesting one. I mean, I would like to take the four of you, because this is something because I'm going to go meet with the different districts. This is a good question to ask them. You know, is there some reason why they think they need those things or what have you? I mean, I don't think they add anything special, and mostly I would probably tend to agree that signs that are lit in other manners, raised letters, backlit, what have you, tend to be, you know, a little bit more architectural looking and, you know, maybe fit a little bit better in with the community. So, I don't know.
One thing, Scott, too, is on the waterfront, now that we have the walkway in the back and we're starting to see tenants wanting to occupy the water side, we've got to think about what the signs look like from the bay as well. And that's where I think this lighting kind of thing really gets questionable, because the more that ends up having the same light levels that the street side has on the waterfront, I think it detracts away from looking at the kind of curve of the bay when you're down at the rock and things like that. So we don't want to have...
And I don't know to what extent that interferes with navigation. That would be... Yeah. You could certainly speak to that.
Yeah, and that... you know, having any direct light sources, you know, essentially takes away your night vision, and so it is a navigational hazard, and you know, I think we need to be really considerate of that on the bayside.
I do think, though, it's district by district. I think you're going to have a hard time with some of the folks in Quintana and North Morro Bay without internally illuminated signs.
I'm only talking about Embarcadero and downtown.
Yeah. Embarcadero and downtown. I think that's correct. We don't need that necessarily.
But there's some, you know, there's also the new lighting technologies are going to offer a lot more choices that we won't even be able to It'd be tough for us to consider here. You know, I can see architectural signs, architectural lettering, where, you know, the lighting is encased in a really fine script. You know, you have LEDs now that are basically, you know, they're 3 or 4 millimeters across and 1 or 2 millimeters high. And so they can essentially, you know, they could be the sign, they could be.
Well, what I was proposing, with the kind of this, to get to into the specifics, what I was thinking is that there might be some signs that would be quote internally illuminated that would be different, you know, that would be artistic even, or that would be historic, you know, but at least we put in language that discourages it, that says we don't like this in these areas, and if you think you fall into the artistic or historic category, apply to the Planning Commission, or
I think that's a good category to have. And I mean, it's one that we don't really have, and it is in there for a couple of things. But to have a category of signs that we have concern about, might be willing to consider, but it should be at the Planning Commission, not staff level. I think that's a good idea. And one of the things I thought was actually missing from the ordinance was things like that, you know, a section of those types of things.
So let me backtrack a little bit. Yeah, I might have missed it, but you know, I could see a sign where you have the lettering, but it's internally illuminated, but the lettering is actually the light is actually backlighting the wall behind, and so the letters are, say, a metal, you know, an opaque metal letter, but you're seeing it as a contrast to the wall. Would that be an internally illuminated sign?
It's lumped in the current ordinance. It's lumped in with them. I would propose that be separated out, and that would not be an internally illuminated, subject again to the total brightness restrictions that are in the ordinance.
Yeah, I think in a way it's hard. I almost want to get a catalog online and look through all the signs that people have. Because I guess the one that disturbs me the most is, because we're talking about the evolving technology, the ability to animate signs and things like that is really very distracting sometimes. We'd have to really be careful about how we want to talk about things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the example there is Limo spent $30,000+ on their sign, and it can basically play videos where, like, our ordinance doesn't allow you to have changing signs like that. And so basically they can – it says open now mostly. certainly I don't think they envisioned spending that type of money on a sign like that. I think they envisioned having the changing typeface and things like that. There also is those changing menu board type signs that might be something that's, you know, considered for the public event type sign things that we have that have the different things on it. So you just have one sign there that has those different things, and they change face every so often. I don't know. It would get rid of having banners, because we get a lot of complaints about what the banners look like. And so maybe if you had something like that, it would be better. So that might be a situation where you might want one, something like that, where it was changed and didn't allow it. I don't know.
They have one of those in Los Osos and on South Bay and
exactly.
LOVR.
Yeah.
But I find that kind of obtrusive, because it seems almost like a Times Square sign or something. Mm-hmm. It may fit some places, but I don't fit it. It'd be tough to see where it would really fit.
Yeah, it was just, we've been struggling because there's been some complaints about the banners and things in our parks, and there's several of them, and that was one of the things that was, at least it's clean looking. It's one. It's not multiple, and those things can look kind of tattered after a little while, and you're constantly having to replace them, and when does it look, banners are never really going to look that great when they're strung between two poles. They're just never really going to look that fantastic, so I don't know.
But again, I can't envision a situation where you could just blanketly say that kind of sign, the changeable sign, is okay. I mean, it's going to have to be in a location that's carefully chosen. If there is one, and again, it needs to come here. There may be occasions where it would be appropriate, but to simply say they're allowed to me is not, you know. The other thing that I would that I brought up last time, and I'm going to bring it up again, is the question of attraction boards. Now, I'm envisioning those, and I think they need to be defined a little bit better in the ordinance. But I'm envisioning it as like a case that you open and you put some sort of a notice of what's coming up at your facility, and then you close it. Right? Right now, they're only allowed for hotels. But you know, there's a lot of businesses in town that have entertainment, you know, and to me it's not a bad thing to be able to walk by and go, oh, my favorite band is coming on Friday, you know. Or to take it to the extreme, you know, if they're not allowed, the Bay Theater can't put out the movie that's coming next week in those cases that they have outside. So I would like to see, you know, I would like to see maybe, and you know, maybe different size attraction boards are appropriate for different businesses. You know, maybe the bar on the corner doesn't need an attraction board as big as the Bay Theater, you know, or as big as, you know, a hotel. But it seems to me that there's a place for those in, you know, other places than just hotels. So I don't know if there's kind of concurrence on.
Yeah, what comes to mind is what I think is an awesome part of the community is the music store, and having that, and that's a, to me, that's one of the real jewels there in our city.
One other thing that's a little bit specific that, but it bugged me is that we have a limitation on the height of freestanding signs which are more than 100 feet from US 1 or Highway 1, but it appears that there's no limitation at all if they're within 100 feet. Except, I suppose, the planes that are approaching to land in San Luis Obispo. The FAA would get involved at that point. But it seems to me that, and I don't know what the appropriate height for it to be. I just kind of threw out 15 feet. But there should be some height that you can say, okay, within 100 feet of one or Highway 101, 1 or 41, this is okay. If you need to go higher than that, you got to come and talk to the Planning Commission about it. And one final thing, I promise, for tonight. It's my observation that the sign ordinance is like one of the most violated ordinances in the city. You know, not only that, what I have seen on occasion, I promise, is, you know, there'll be a complaint. Somebody from the city will go out, the place will get cleaned up, and within about 3 weeks, all the signs are back again, you know. It seems to me that we need an enforcement mechanism. Okay, that it's not good enough just to go out and go naughty, 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 take down your sign. There needs to be, at least for repeat offenders, there needs to be some penalty involved.
We already have that. It's already built into our ordinance, because this is an ordinance as part of the municipal code. Chapter was a one applies, and so it has the violation. It's the, you violate the municipal code, it's considered a nuisance. We can fine you $100 for the first offense, $200 for the second offense, $500 for offenses beyond, you know, offenses beyond that within the same month. So we do have that available to us. And with our current ordinance, the way that it's, because it is part of the municipal code, we do have that there. And I actually have citation books in my office. So that's going to be something where we go over with the code enforcement folks when they get on board.
Are they still full?
Yes, they are.
Forms?
Yes, they are. Yeah. And I don't even know how old they are. They when I took over planning and building, you know, Rob Leivick rounded them up from where he knew, where the secret stashes where they were at, and he's like, "Hey, we have all these."
Well, but I mean, as part of this outreach process, I think one of the things that, because I mean, honestly, I wasn't aware of that tie-in. You know what I'm saying? It can't hurt to make the community aware of that. So, you know, look, guys, you know, this is going to be the ordinance, and we're going to be serious about it, and here's what the penalties are.
It is part of what we're doing. We're going to be doing for outreach. Yes, okay. It's part of the program.
Sorry, another question. Would balloons or blimps or stuff like that, would that be part of the inflatable signs? It seemed like that's a...
Is there a section in there for that?
There's inflatable signs.
There's inflatable signs, but...
UAVs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're talking about new technologies. You could run a drone circling your business with lights and banners and what have you. You know? So maybe aerial signs or something.
Well, the saving grace here, I think, with some of this overriding concern is, the saving grace is that for each district, there's a list of the signs that are approvable.
Yeah.
And the statement that everything else is not a is prohibited. So Scott has the authority to say, you know, drones are not on they're not on the list here. So there is it's not wide open, you know,
it's not.
From that point.
It's not. I would agree with that.
So any is that
that was it. That, you guys gave me some good input. I think a lot of what I'm going to do with this is several of the things are things that aren't either well defined in the ordinance currently or really addressed in the ordinance. And I think I'll probably put this as together as a list and talk to the individual areas, at least where it's applicable to the individual commercial areas when I go conduct the workshops with them and get input from them so you can have that. You know, I said, hey, when I talked to them about it, this was their concern about that or what. I mean, I think that's worthwhile. And I'm not, again, in looking through the notes from when we conducted these back in the workshops back in 2013, 2014, it doesn't seem like it was too broad. It wasn't a very broad-reaching discussion that was had out there. Although the city had been engaged in this effort for a while, so it's a little unclear to me. You know, maybe they were just tired of talking about it. I don't know. maybe they felt that they'd given their input. I mean, I shouldn't say tired of talking about it. They'd given their input, and you know, this was sort of the end game or the sort of the last hurrah on it. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell from notes.
My sense is the kind of economic recession drove people to try to have more signs, and so there was sign proliferation that crossed the line into things that people thought were getting really tacky.
Yeah.
And I think that's the foundational part is what do we want to have the city look like? But, you know, you've got these creative people sinking, you know, huge amounts of money into businesses. So I want to make sure we listen to them really carefully. But there's certainly a track record of things that don't seem to appeal to the person we want to have come here and spend the weekend and go out and walk the streets and go to the restaurants and promenade the Embarcadero. I mean, there's a certain level of sophistication you have to have or everything sort of falls apart.
Yeah.
You know, and to dovetail into that, you know, the thought is that, you know, as a business owner and have applied for sign permits and stuff, you know, I would love to, you know, I would love to plaster signage everywhere, but you know it becomes the case that the more you do, the less you get back. So, you know, I think we need to follow that because if it's like you're standing in a crowd, the first person stands up and everybody stands up, you don't have any better view of than if everybody had sat down.
Yeah.
But you know, the other thing too is that the stakeholders and the residents and the business owners may not be the best parties to determine who has the final say on what's best for the community at whole too.
I think it's just important to go and talk to them and listen to what they have to say, and they may have very good reasons why they want certain types of signage and reasons that, quite frankly, I haven't thought of, you haven't thought of. Mm-hmm. And so when you get that context given to you, you, like you do with many things, might change your mind.
Right.
And so that's what you want to hear. I mean, when I sat down with the folks in the downtown, there wasn't anything crazy that came out of their mouths about things. They didn't want anything that wasn't stuff that was already either considered in the ordinance or that the city had been talking about for a while. There wasn't really a whole lot of, you know, off-the-wall ideas there. They were just saying, hey, these are the issues that we have, and we're trying to address them by X, Y, and Z. And they were all very articulate in their descriptions about what they desired. And that was probably the best part, because they knew, you know, why they wanted this type of signage or why they wanted that type of signage and what they thought it would bring to them. Now, whether you agree with it's actually going to bring that to them or not, I don't, you know, up for debate. But they knew why they wanted it, and they were able to articulate that. So I think that's what will come out of this. They were very well spoken on it, and they didn't have – it wasn't a shotgun approach. It was really like, hey, these are interesting things that we would like to consider, and so are these. And why don't we allow X, Y, and Z? Why – what are those problems? And so it was a good discussion.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to, you know – denigrate, you know, the, you know, the business owners and stuff, but it was just that they're, you know, they have a perspective, and the city has another perspective, and so it just has to be balanced, and something works out. It should work out for the best for all.
Why we have planning commissions looking at it and city councils adopting it. I mean, that's certainly the case.
Yeah. And I think an important question is not so much what kind of sign would you like for your business, but what kind of sign would you like next door to your business? What kind of sign do you want to have to compete against? You know, because, you know, he's right. You can get into a nuclear arms race. If you're not careful. Okay. So, you got it? You got what you need?
I am good. I appreciate the input. Thank you.
So, we have no new business tonight. So, we'll move on to Planning Commissioner comments. Are there any comments or future agenda items or?
Yeah, I think that if everybody agrees, I really think that we should talk about the vacation rental issues. And one of the things that I found, I think last year San Francisco was addressing some of those issues with the cost of housing. And they had a short-term residential rental ordinance. And they had a situation where a community, a residential area, turns into like a de facto hotel situation, and I think that we need to look at that. And I'm where I'm coming from on that, Scott, is my concern is from the surcharging of our infrastructure, and this is something that is a real issue when it comes to when you look at the city and you're looking at, you know, the WRF project and water usage and stuff. So if we could at least have a discussion, if you know, about it.
So let's see if you really want to have the discussion. We have 166 registered vacation rentals in town. We have over 4,000 residential units. Is it an issue? I don't know. Mass is in the, you know, we still have mass going on, so there was the potential that we are underrepresented there. But we don't have a whole, there's not, it's not like we have 700 or 800 of them. We have 166, and in last discussion I had with the business license folks, some of those had expired, and they were unclear whether they were continuing on to operate or whether they just hadn't come back in yet to get their business licenses. So
the sort of the contrary statistic is that there's a 20% vacancy rate for housing in Morro Bay. So that 20% is predominantly vacation homes, but they're not rented out. Is where they're at.
Yeah, okay. They're secondary homes for folks that probably predominantly live in the valley.
Right.
That factor of, you know, Morro Bay and when I came from Pismo is almost exactly the same. We had a, you know, huge population of folks that either stay at secondary homes in town. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, certainly happy to have the conversation. I'm just saying, when you look at it, because I was asked the question about how many of these we had, and when I found out we had 166, I was like, that's not a lot.
Yeah.
It's a very small percentage, and so, I was actually surprised. I just literally found this out. So this was right before the last council meeting, actually, I found that out. Yeah. And I was a little surprised to see that I thought it was going to be much higher. Pismo Beach has just under, was it 300, I think, maybe a little bit more than that. Maybe it was 4-something. I think maybe it was 3 or 4-something. I forget now off the top of my head. But
I'm very surprised about that figure. It's shocking, actually.
I was too. But it's one of the, and so you say, well, there's a whole bunch out there that aren't being reported. There are probably some, but it's one of the things that Mass is looking for. So, and we got a bunch of vacation rental registrations as a result of the Mass audit. So this is what they do. So they were able to go out there and find them and then contact those folks and have them come in, because we ended up getting quite a few vacation rental applications as part of that process. And we still continue to get them. But
Scott, are you finding any health and safety issues with these Airbnb rentals or online rentals?
At some point, it's probably worthwhile to start looking about how you regulate some of these things, because our ordinance doesn't really pick them up right now.
Because I'm kind of thinking of fire egress, making sure that the windows are properly sized for somebody for a firefighter to get through, because
we don't have. I mean, our ordinance doesn't currently address that.
Okay.
So, but those are potentially, as the city maybe gets more of those things, there might be stuff we want to start taking a look at. Some cities will do that. They have requirements for them. Some don't. I think far fewer have requirements that go along those lines. They just require you to register and pay your TOT and, one of the biggest things is to have the notice on the front of the building that says, hey, your 24-hour contact person is, and this is their number. So when they're having the party, the neighbor next door can call the responsible party to have it addressed.
I think part of the election that's happening in San Francisco right now is dealing with that, putting a limitation on how many days somebody could offer, a bedroom for rent. I think one of the provisions.
I think so. That list of phone numbers is another thing that would be very nice to have online. You know what I'm saying? So if the party goers happen to rip down the sign, go to the city website. There it is.
Yeah. One of the other things that our ordinance doesn't require is that I've seen in other areas is the posting of the notification to the adjacent neighbors when we get an application. And I thought that would be good, because then that information is given out to the surrounding folks around it, so you get it. It comes to you.
Right.
Here you go. There's a contact thing. Go put it in your contacts list, so when you have that problem, it's out there. And that's something I've... It's on one. I have lists of things that I want to fix in the ordinance, and that's what's one of the things I want to talk about. I mean, as part of the general plan update, then I kind of have a list on the side that I put for things that are worth, I think, conversation. That's one of them. So.
I guess to me, it's something too that eventually responds to enforcement, because my biggest concern, because I live in a part of town where it seems like there's an awful lot of vacation homes. People just aren't there most of the time. But what would concern me is if I thought I was in a single-family residential area and all of a sudden a number of homes around me would be, there's a four-bedroom house and all of a sudden it becomes four Airbnb reservations with maybe six or eight cars. And now instead of the two cars in the driveway, half the street is littered with these extra cars. So there's an assumption that if I'm coming into a neighborhood, especially with some of the investments that some of these houses take now, that I have a certain expectation of what the neighborhood is going to be like. That doesn't guarantee somebody's going to be there all the time, but if it seems like there's a surplus of vehicles or noise or something like that, but some of that then comes under enforcement, I think, eventually. So,
It is, something I sort of keep my eye on, specifically the Airbnb thing. There are cities, as you state, that are going through the process right now of developing ordinances to address how you deal with those things. I'm always a fan of not being the first one out of the box to do that. I don't think that I want to work for the city that goes out there and constantly tests the court system. I like to be boring and like, okay, we have a whole bunch of cities that have done this. It's been well litigated, and at the end they said pretty much this is what you can do and it works, and we can go, thanks, and go take it and scratch out the name, put Morro Bay on it, and tweak it how we want it, and we're good to go. That's sort of my approach to some of those things. Anyway. So that is, but I do keep my eye on it because I do, it is interesting to me to see how that is, having worked for, you know, cities for the majority of my career that are, have a strong tourist base, you know, it's interesting to see how those things are regulated.
Any other comments from the commission? Scott, comments from your office?
We did officially release the RFP for the general plan update. That was on the 23rd of October. The RFPs are due on November 24th, and we anticipate being able to go through those, interview the firms, and have the contract for the consultant on the city council agenda for the first meeting in January. That's the timeline. So that's coming. It's out finally, and we've gotten responses from four now, I guess, companies, and a couple of dipping their toe in the water, you know, things from a couple of other folks that were just inquiring about pieces and parts. We did not only list it on our website, send it out to some of our local consultants here in San Luis Obispo County, but did put it on the national APA webpage, American Planning Association, so it's out there for everybody to see. And we had good timing because there wasn't any other general plans on the list at the time, so I was happy about that, like being the only one. So with that, we should hopefully get a good amount of RFPs, responses anyway, and I'm looking forward to those coming through. I think next week we have our pre-proposal meeting. It's not a requirement, but it we'll have the pre-proposal meeting over at the community center. And so we'll have some of those folks and be able to go over if they have questions or what the expectation is. And we did do ours a little bit differently when we did the plan for the plan. Normally the plan for the plan is, you know, something that comes after you hire a consultant, and you'll get a little bit of a preliminary work plan in a kind of in an outline format in your RFP. So we already had that kind of done. So it'll be interesting to see what the consultants do with that, because it kind of says this is what you're supposed to do. And so in the RFP, I specifically said, well, unless you have other ideas that you think might be better, then go ahead and put them in there and explain why they're better. Because we want to pick and choose all the best pieces that are out there of options for us. And that's what one of the benefits of doing the RFP and going out and talking to all the different consultants that do general plan updates. So that's coming online finally, we already mentioned it, but we do our next planning commission meeting, you know, is not going to be at the regularly scheduled one at the 17th. We'll have this room full of council members that day. It'll be the following week on the 24th. That's all I got.
Okay, very good. Well, with that, we have no further business, and so we will adjourn our meeting to the next regularly scheduled meeting on November 24th here in the Betts Hall. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think we've been trying to reduce our paper waste, and so we do hand a lot of these things out.